Session number 11885, Mrs. J. H. Mills, Reel 3.
Mrs. Mills, Reel 3. What work were you personally doing at Bentley Priory?
Well, first of all, I was plotting. And then after a while, I was given my corpus. No, before the strikes came, I was sent up to do to trace, which I'd always wanted to do. There were two tracers up on the balcony over the table, and they were responsible for committing to paper a large map in black and white of everything that appeared on the table, together with the time it appeared and all the relevant details. And it was very, very interesting, quite hard work, especially, you know, if you're in the southeast corner. But we used to keep a record of the whole of the activities in the whole of the British Isles. I often wonder what's happened to these, if they're now available to the public eye, because it was very useful. For instance, when you know, I was on duty when the Scharnhorst and Eisenhower sort of made a bid to get away, and that we had a whole lot of top brass from all the three services in the operations room, and you know, it was really very, very interesting. We could hardly bear to go off duty in case we missed something while we were off.
What do you remember about that channel breakout?
Well, just that there was a lot of cooperation, shall we say, to use a kind word for it, between the fighter and bomber command and the Navy. They had differences of opinion quite often about the course to take, but you know,
was that obvious to you?
Yes, because you see that the controller, who in this case would nearly always be an air commodore, and they had many more liaison people and many more other people from different branches around at officer rank. And one could hear their conversations, of course, because they spoke on the telephone and received orders on the telephone. And then we had, I say, quite a lot of important people who would come in, and we were quite aware of what was going on. Although the room was much bigger than the one at Duxford, it wasn't so big that we couldn't hear what was said most of the time.
Were there any hard words said in your hearing?
No, I don't think so. No, not in public. You know, we could get the gist of conversations, and there were differences of opinion, but I think, you know, it didn't lead to any great tragedies or anything.
Why did you want to transfer from plotting to tracing?
Well, I didn't really. Oh, from plotting to tracing, I thought you meant from Duxford. Well, I didn't really want to go from Duxford because it was, you know, there was an active fighting station, whereas Command was just that. It was there was no active flyers there. But well, yes, but I thought it would be more interesting. I've been plotting for quite a long time. I suppose this was about the beginning of 42, and you know, sometimes you had to. It was the luck of the draw. Sometimes you got the busy places like the southeast corner or East Anglia and things like that. You'd be stationed there, but you had to take your turn at the sort of north of Scotland, where virtually nothing ever happened. You read a great number of books, and I just thought it would be nice. And also, I thought it was about time I got some kind of promotion. And you know, there wasn't a great deal of establishment for the promotion for plotters. You could be, go as far as that LACW, which was Leading Aircraft Woman, and there were very few corporals. The corporal establishment was quite small. And they say, the girls, if you're in an operations room, you really liked the work and you didn't want to go. So that if you once became a CO, you know, that was the establishment field and you hadn't got any hope. But tracers were carried the rank of corporal as well, and I think that was at the back of my mind. But I enjoyed the work, I really liked it. I'd always, and I'd been keen on drawing, and I suppose it had a certain affinity for that kind of thing. But it was, and also it was an extended one a little as well. You know, you really had to put everything into it. It was hard going. You had to, because you know, people would come and look. I mean, the officers and the different services would come and look over your shoulder and see perhaps where this certain raid had originated or where it had been intercepted and things like that, and it was all obvious from your sheet.
Were you able to take more pride in the work than with
yes,
plotting?
Yes, I did. I wouldn't say that, but at least you had some. It was there in black and white, you know, you could see some results for it. The plotting, you worked absolutely ding-dong, all out, and then at the end of 15 minutes, the plots had be gone. You were very conscious of plotting that it was vital. I mean, it would be a great mistake, in fact, it would endanger lives even, if you say you plotted in entirely the wrong square or something like that. I mean, you know, the course of the war could change. I mean, that's exaggerating slightly, but you know, I mean, it would be dreadful if the CO had sent squadrons up to the wrong place, for instance.
Did you see Dowding or any of the other VIPs there?
I think I must have done. I remember seeing Lee Mallory and I think I saw Sholto Douglas as well. A lot of people we saw and didn't realise at the time who they were. I remember seeing quite a lot of the past. I remember seeing Richard Hillary. You know, he was the one who got completely, terribly bad burns. And I remember he walked on the platform and we looked up. And I remember consciously thinking, you mustn't flinch, you know, you mustn't avert your gaze, you must just look at him as if it's just like anybody else, because it was in the early days and his face was absolutely livid, you know, the scars, that kind of person we saw. But it was really, I'd enjoyed Duxford, this was different, this was more, it's more of a stretching experience, you know, it stretched one's abilities more, and it was also more interesting in the fact the way you could get the whole picture of everything. I remember very vividly the first time, you know, the 100-plus bomber raids started, and we were on duty one night, and it had been fairly quiet. That's the thing, there were periods of absolute inactivity, you know, where you had to sort of do something to keep yourself from being bored, and then there was this intense activity, and I remember we suddenly looked up, and one girl sort of stood up and put a plot way out on the North Sea, and then in no time at all there was a whole row of plots coming, and then there was the sergeant of the watch conferred with the CO, the controller, and they removed all the individual plots and put a long stretch of cardboard on, covering several hundred miles, and it was a sort of 300 plus front of bombers coming, and you asked whether we were scared. Well, that really, we began to wonder what was going to happen and in which direction they would go, and then of course that became a frequent thing. We often had these great fronts of bombers coming for the 300 plus, 500 plus raids.
Were those British bombers going to Germany,
no,
or German bombers
German
going to...
No, bombers coming over, no. No, that's why, you know, that I can remember almost audible sort of gasps coming from everybody around the table when they saw what was happening, and great, suddenly the whole place would galvanise into activity. The people on the platform would get busy sort of getting people to readiness and, you know, conferring with group headquarters in various parts of the country.
Do you remember anything going seriously wrong which shouldn't have happened?
No, but then I don't suppose we might not have heard of it. Do you mean in fact that people didn't sort of...
In the organisation of the Fighter Command Headquarters?
No, I don't remember that at all. And it's quite interesting to I think in Churchill, in his history of the Second World War, he says that the Battle of Britain was won on four counts. The first was the skill and daring of the pilots. The second was the efficiency of their machines. And the third was the efficient organisation of fighter command, which I think, you know, really, it really was organised well. And the fourth, of course, was the stamina and spirit of the British people. It was the first time, really, that the war had been fought by civilians as much as the services. I mean, you know, in the old days, used to send the men off to war and the women used to sit at home and wear bandages. But I think this time it was just as much the civilian population involved as the services.
Did you feel discriminated against as a woman in the RAF?
No. No. Not, I'd say, after about the first... perhaps week or so at Duxford, when there was a really dreadful bull of a flight sergeant who, you know, on principle was going to be tough to the women to let them see they weren't going to get away with anything, and then after that it was all right. No, not at all, not at all. In fact, I think, you know, I think it all fitted in quite well.
Did you feel that women were wanted in the war effort?
Yes, yes, I'm sure they were. I mean, if you weren't in the services, they were wanted in a whole lot of other ways. I mean, one of my sisters was a VAD, and they did tremendous work as well. And there were people in factories and air raid wardens, and just everybody. I think the people we appreciated very, very much were the WVS, the Women's Voluntary Services, because they had marvellous canteens everywhere, you know, wherever you seem to need them, they were there, and it was a very nice atmosphere, and, you know, it's more like a touch and a breath of home, which, of course, your thoughts are very much, you know, however happy you are and however exciting life is, your thoughts are very much at home, and your one idea is to be able to get home sometime, you know.
You were talking about the VIPs at Fighter Command Headquarters, but I got the impression that you don't have any specific memories of them, such as you've recounted for Douglas Bader, for example.
No, because they came and went. They were transitory, really. I mean, in fact, I suppose we got quite blasé because there were a constant stream of people would come in. It was quite convenient for London, you know, and it was a place, I suppose, for sort of politicians to pop in. We didn't see Churchill or anything like that. We did have Duxford. We had the King and Queen who came to see us. That was quite interesting. It's going back on the tracks a little.
Did your work at Bentley Priory vary very much?
No. Well, only in as much as we worked different shifts. You know, we had an eight-hour shift all through the night, and then in the day, you know, daytime, the place was manned 24 hours a day, of course, and, you know, I can't remember exactly the times of the shifts, but, no, it was the same thing. It might vary in either that we were on one position of plotting, or we might be a sort of clerk for the Coastal Command liaison officer, or we might, you know, do various sort of auxiliary jobs there, but by and large, you know, we had pretty much the same thing to do, and in fact, you know, they soon sort of weeded out the people who are perhaps a little quicker or more, you know, accurate plotters than the others, and you know, you get to get the better places on the table and so on and so forth. But apart from that, it was just jogged along from day to day. We used to, of course, we had the benefit of being able to go up to town quite easily from Stanmore Met Line. We were billeted out in Stanmore, and we used to march up. They marched us up, would you believe, to duty some of the times, and sometimes we had a bus at night. But we could get up to town quite easily, and you know, some of the girls who had contacts in town would be up there quite a lot, or the ones who hadn't lived in London and weren't used to the, well, I mean, say the bright lights, weren't you bright lights at the inside, but weren't, you know, used to the social life, wanted to sort of do the whole thing and, you know, go around the various hotels and restaurants and things, and theatres, of course, theatres are open.
I keep saying Bentley Priory and you keep saying Stanmore.
Oh,
what's
yes.
the difference?
Well, nothing. It's just that Stanmore is the town, really, or the suburb, and Bentley Priory was the actual building, the estate. But a lot of people, I suppose, don't realise, you know, what Bentley Priory was.
You've mentioned the Channel breakout and the big German Air Force bomber raids. Were there any other events in the war which stick out in your mind from your days at Fighter Command?
No, I don't really think so. Nothing strikes me at this distance, no. It's amazing, really, but with all this going on internationally, all our private lives are all very important to us, you know, and where we were going, what we were doing off duty, and who we were going with, and, you know, the interests of the moment. And not so much at Stanmore, but at Bentley Priory, because we were so near town, but at Duxford, you know, they did their very best to have lots going on, and, you know, the activities like sort of, you know, there were ENSA concerts and films and camp dances and roller skating in the hangar and badminton, all that kind of thing. You know, so that I think it was the idea at the time that you know, one mustn't dwell on things. They were momentary, and that was that. And tomorrow is another day.
So the war, in a sense, was in the background.
Well, it seems ridiculous to say so. It was very much there, but It wasn't the most important thing in our lives. I mean, it wasn't our abiding thought and day and night, shall we say, which is amazing when you look back. Especially, I was interested to hear at the beginning of this Gulf War how a lot has been said about how the children must be counselled and how this person, that person must be advised. And, I mean, we didn't have any of that. And the rest of my family, four of them, all grew up during the war, and I don't think they turned out to be unbalanced people, any of them, and yet nobody would have thought of counselling them. You know, they all knew what was going on.
Now, I'd like to jump ahead in your career to Gravesend, because you went into balloon command at RAF Gravesend in
yes.
June 1944.
Yes.
Can you tell me about going there?
Yes. I was very depressed at the start of it, because I'd been at Netherhaven with the airborne services since I'd been commissioned. And on the very eve of D-Day, when there were searchlights shining up to make a meeting point in the sky above Salisbury Plain, I was posted to crew to balloon command. And my first thought was, earth have I done to deserve this? And balloon command, although very worthy, was known to be sort of rather mature people and ex-businessmen. It was the best-run command, I think, or one of the best-run commands, because it was run very efficiently by these ex-businessmen, but it was a kind of place where people went if they weren't medically fit for anything else, so to speak. And to be sent up to crew, which was sort of, as far as I was concerned, was out in the sticks. So I felt sure that I must have had some bad report from somebody. However, I got up there, and I was only there a week before but we were told that we were all going down to Kent. It was going to be this, the balloon command was going to mount this massive curtain of balloons across southeast England as protection against the doodle bombs, which are doodle bugs, which had just started. And the idea being that the trailing wires from the balloons would trap the doodle bugs, they'd become entangled and be brought down before they got into the more densely populated areas. Well, that was a tremendous triumph of organisation. I think balloon squadrons came from all over the country and they were dispersed on about a 20-mile front. I know it stretched from Gravesend right across to Maidstone, Seven Oaks, that part of the world. And I know we had about 200 scattered sites all over our part of Kent. And we were responsible for an area between the river Chatham and Rochester, right across to Seven Oaks, and we had squadrons of balloons scattered all over the farmers' fields. The farmers were very, very sort of understanding and good about it all, and very good to the men. And of course, the little lanes of Kent were clogged with these great lorries of hydrogen, which were constantly delivering supplies to the balloons. And the actual headquarters was at Gravesend at a sort of place called Laughing Water, which was a great big wooded area. And it was completely camouflaged. There were so many pine trees. I remember being amazed when I first saw it, because all the huts were completely, you know, administration huts and the messes were all hidden in these pine trees. And the main area been a fighter station before at Gravesend was about a mile away towards the river, nearer the river, but all our headquarters were in there. And we came down, and I was a catering officer by then, and the chief and the man in charge of the whole outfit and the whole catering side was a very experienced Scotsman, done years of commercial catering behind him. And the CEO of the whole thing was also a very experienced balloon command man, and he'd really organized this whole thing wonderfully well. I mean, squadrons came down at intervals, they knew exactly where they were to go. I mean, the sites had to be equipped with mobile cookers, and you know, everything was done like that. However, he ran it all in a very businesslike way, and every evening the heads of all the officers from the various departments, whoever was available, all the headquarters administrative officers, were summoned to a sort of business meeting after dinner every night and in his office, and we were all told, asked if we had any problems and what we were, how we were planning to arrange such and such a thing, or you know, how the distribution of the rations was to be arranged, and if we had enough staff, you know, all the little details, anything at all that we wanted to know, we could talk to him about, and it was excellent. So I was very new at that time. There was only this senior catering officer and myself, and remember, we were going back. I hadn't yet been issued with a bicycle because they hadn't got enough or something, but he had a bicycle, and we were cycling back from this meeting to the mess, and he was cycling very slowly because I was walking by the side of him, and he was telling me, you know, about his plans and how what he'd organised already and how the whole thing was to be run. And suddenly he just fell off his bike by the side of the road, and I sort of went to help him up, and he couldn't get up. He'd broken his leg, so he had to go into hospital. And the CEO obviously thought at that time it was going to be quite a short affair, and he would come back. So he gave orders that I was to be left in charge of this operation, which was a bit daunting. But I'd worked with Jock, and I knew what his plans were. And I used to go to hospital and every day and tell him, he would tell me, you know, what he had planned for the next move. And so it went on. And I remember he said to me, one thing I say to you, he said, don't ever leave anything. Whatever you were doing that day, get it finished. Don't let it hang over, which was really excellent advice. And I always tried to stick to that in anything, really. And anyway, he had complications and was stuck in hospital and then was sent on somewhere else. And the cut a long story short, the CO flatly refused to have anybody else sent down to take over, and he wanted me left in charge of it, which was, I must say, you know, due to the original organisation, I could cope with it. I knew what was going on, and I really enjoyed it. But it was a bit embarrassing, because then came a series of assistant case rotating officers. I think the establishment was for about four or five of us, and there were these sort of really mature, middle-aged, experienced hoteliers and people coming down, and I was in charge of them, you know. But we got over it, because I was 23 at the time, actually, so you can imagine how I felt. But we managed to give them all their own little areas to look after. And I say, there were all these squadrons scattered about, and the main problem was of distribution, because they all had to get their rations, and we were all on field rations. And so it turned that every day, or every alternate day, they would send up transport from wherever they were all over Kent and collect the rations. And of course, the containers were a problem. I don't know if you're familiar with sort of service rations, but you get sort of 2/7 of an ounce of butter and things like that a day, you know. And you've got to have containers. There'd probably be 7 or maybe 10 men on a site. And so they got over the thing. This was another of Jock's brilliant ideas. They used old ammunition boxes, which seemed to come in various sizes. There were large boxes, and then with all these little tins, and came bits of sugar and flour and oatmeal and all that kind of thing. You know, but they all had to come and queue up. We had a long, long line of lorries, like a convoy every day. And then we had this rather large room where girls were busy weighing out these things. You know, I mean, it seems terribly clumsy, and these days it'd all be supplied packed and in, you know, one man for one day or something. But that's the only way they all survived. And I was given a motor. They were short of transport, so I couldn't have a van, so they gave me a motorcycle and sidecar with the driver, and I rode in the sidecar with my hat on. And we went round all the remote sites.
What kind of people were manning the sites?
The airmen who were in charge of the balloons, I think they call them riggers. I'm not sure. You see, I was so new to balloon command, I didn't know much about it, but I knew about catering. So,
how effective do you think the balloon system in the Gravesend area was?
Well, they brought
the
quite a lot of things down. They did bring a lot down. I think it must have been of some use, because I just forget the numbers. Actually, I have got a leaflet about it which appeared in an extract from the Kent Messenger at the time. And a lot were brought down. I don't know the exact figures.
Did you see any actually brought down?
Yes. Now and again, you could see the flames. Well, first of all, you knew they were there because you could hear the sound, you know, the intermittent engine noise. And then you could see when and if they were brought down, you could see that they just burst into flames. But, you know, we'd go around to the balloon sites, and they'd show us great pride. This was brought down by, you know, this one in the farmer's field and that kind of thing.
So you just see a pile of wreckage?
Yes, yeah. And, of course, unfortunately, it didn't work against the V2s, which were the really scary things. I was billeted out in the house, sort of in the middle of fields, and I had the attic bedroom, and it had a window at each end, and I could look south through that window and see the little glow in the sky and hear the buzz and just hope that I could look out of the other window at the opposite side of the room and see it disappearing.
So the V1s would hit the balloon or the wire?
No, the V2s. The V1s, yes, I beg your pardon. Well, either, I mean, mostly the wires, because they had these training halls, and they were quite, they needed a lot of skillful attention, especially. Yes, well, they did need a lot of attention in high winds, because they would blow about, and the halls and wires would trail, and they were suspended, of course, from rather heavy motor transport of some kind. They had to be winched in.
What was morale like during the V weapons raid? Did people feel that they could stick it out?
I think that the V2s weren't quite so, the V1s weren't quite so bad because you could hear them coming, and you knew you could either die for shelter or else they, you know, when the sound stopped, you knew they were coming down somewhere. But the V2s, I think, had the war gone on much longer, they really would have got at people because they just came out of the blue and you had no warning. And I mean, if you knew they'd landed, well, you were the lucky one who hadn't been hit. But I mean, obviously, you didn't know anything about them until they landed. And they were scary. But by that time, I think we'd left Gravesend, the area. You know, the purpose of it all was over.
Were many V weapons coming down in the Gravesend area? Or were they going on?
I think mostly they went on to the outskirts of London. Yes, southern outskirts. If they got past the Ack and the balloons, and then of course there were always some fighters. I think I heard some bizarre story about fighters used to try and tip them with their wings. Seemed to me an incredibly dangerous thing to do.